A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been sourcing home inventory and storage systems. Industrial shelving, climate-controlled bins, the kind of stuff warehouses buy by the pallet. But he's buying 3 to 5 units at a time for a home business. And he noticed something weird. When you send a well-structured quote request, even as a tiny buyer, you can get competitive pricing and actual human attention from sales reps who normally ignore anyone below enterprise scale. The question is, what makes a quote request good from the seller's perspective, and what are the concrete moves that turn a small order into something they want to win? There's a real asymmetry here worth unpacking.
The asymmetry is wild once you look at the numbers. A $50,000 enterprise quote lands with a dedicated account manager, a personalized follow-up call, maybe a site visit. Meanwhile, a $500 consumer purchase gets a chatbot that loops you through 6 help articles and a form that nobody reads. But a $500 B2B purchase, if it's structured right, can land somewhere in the middle, and sometimes closer to the high end. That gap is what we're talking about.
The stakes are not trivial. I saw a National Small Business Association survey from the second quarter of this year. Over 40% of small business owners said procurement friction was their top operational bottleneck. Opaque pricing, ignored quote requests, radio silence from suppliers. That's not a minor annoyance. That's people losing hours every week, chasing vendors who won't write back.
It's not because the suppliers are jerks. It's because their systems are calibrated for a specific type of customer. Large, repeat, predictable margin. When you fall outside that profile, you land in what I'd call the dead zone. Too small for the enterprise sales team, too complex for the self-service portal. Nobody's job description covers you.
Which is why the quote request itself becomes the entire game. It's not a price discovery mechanism. It's a relationship negotiation disguised as a form. Master the form, and you reshape the relationship.
That's the thesis right there. And I want to ground this in something real, because this isn't theory. When I was setting up my home practice storage, medical supplies, shelving, climate-controlled bins, I sourced from industrial suppliers. Uline, Global Industrial, a few regional warehouse outfitters. I was buying 3 units, 4 units, 5 units. And I learned very quickly that the difference between getting ignored and getting a call from a rep within 30 minutes was entirely about how I structured the ask.
Walk me through what a good ask looks like. If I'm sitting down to request a quote, what am I actually putting in that form?
Let's start with what most people do, because the baseline is instructive. The typical small buyer types something like, "How much for some heavy-duty shelves?" into the contact form. Maybe they include a link to a product page, then they wait, and nothing happens.
Because that request screams, "I'm going to be work."
From the seller's perspective, that message means they're going to spend the next week going back and forth clarifying which shelves, how many, where they're going, what kind of loading dock you have, whether you need liftgate service, what your payment terms are. Every one of those back and forth emails costs the rep time, and time is the thing they're optimizing against. There was a Harvard Business Review study in 2024 that quantified this. B2B sales reps spend 40% of their time on administrative follow-up, just clarifying and chasing information.
So if I can eliminate most of that follow-up before it starts, I'm not just being polite, I'm altering their cost-to-serve calculation. And cost-to-serve is the hidden variable in every pricing decision.
That's the core insight. The price you get isn't just a function of volume. It's a function of volume minus the anticipated hassle. A $500 order that requires 0 handholding can be more profitable per dollar than a $5,000 order that requires 3 calls, 2 site visits, and a custom configuration.
What does a 0 handholding quote request actually look like? Give me the anatomy.
All right, here's the template I landed on after trial and error. First, line item specificity. You list the exact SKU numbers, exact quantities, and your preferred unit of measure, each case pallet. Not some shelves, not the big ones. You copy the SKU from their catalog and you paste it in. This does two things. One, it tells the rep you've already done the product research, so they're not going to have to educate you. Two, it signals that you're comparing prices across suppliers, which subtly implies they're in competition.
The SKU is a shibboleth. It tells them you speak the language.
And most small buyers don't include SKUs because they think the rep will look it up. The rep could look it up. But the moment you make them look it up, you've added 5 minutes of work to their plate, and those 5 minutes are being weighed against the margin on your order.
What's the second piece?
You provide your zip code, your loading dock specs, dock high versus ground level, and your preferred delivery window up front. If you don't have a loading dock, you say so, and you ask about liftgate service in the same sentence. Delivery to commercial address, ground level, will need liftgate. That sentence alone probably saves 3 emails.
Because the alternative is them quoting freight to a residential address, you coming back saying, actually it's a business, them re-quoting, you asking about liftgate, them checking with the carrier, that's a week of back and forth.
Every round of that back and forth erodes their margin and their patience. The third piece is payment terms. You state up front, net 30 upon approval, or credit card at order. Removing uncertainty about how and when they get paid is a huge, de-risking move for their finance team. If you leave payment terms unspecified, someone in accounts receivable has to flag your order and ask, which adds delay and friction.
Before I've even talked to a human, I've signaled, I know what I want, I know where it's going, I know how I'm paying. That's the easy customer signal.
The easy customer signal is the most undervalued lever in B2B pricing. I want to be precise about why. Sales reps in B2B industrial supply typically have discretionary pricing authority, usually 10 to 20% off list, without needing manager approval. Multiple sales management surveys back this up. The rep can apply that discount at their judgment, and their judgment is shaped by one question. Is this buyer going to be a headache? If the answer is no, that discount often gets applied automatically because the rep wants to close the deal fast and move on to the next one.
The discount isn't a reward for volume. It's a reward for low touch.
In many cases, yes. The volume discount and the low touch discount come from the same pool of discretionary authority. The rep doesn't care which justification they use internally. They just need the order to close cleanly.
There's something almost counterintuitive here. Most people assume you get better pricing by being a squeaky wheel, demanding, negotiating hard, asking for the manager. But in B2B, the squeaky wheel gets the surcharge.
The squeaky wheel gets routed to the rep who handles problem accounts, and that rep has seen everything and has no incentive to discount. Meanwhile, the buyer who sends a clean RFQ with all the information responds to follow-ups within an hour and never asks a question that's answered on the product page. That buyer gets the just-get-it-done pricing.
Let's talk about the minimum viable order problem. Daniel's buying 3 to 5 shelving units. A warehouse might buy 300. How do you make 3 units look like a relationship worth starting rather than a one-off nuisance?
This is where the framing matters enormously. You don't lie. Lying in B2B is a terrible idea because these industries are small and reps talk, but you can imply future volume without committing to it. The phrase I use is something like, this is a pilot for a planned 12-unit rollout across 2 locations. I need pricing on 3 units now to validate the setup.
That's elegant. You're not promising a future order. You're describing a future scenario that makes you more interesting to price aggressively today. And if the pilot doesn't expand, well, pilots sometimes don't.
The rep understands this. They've seen pilots that turned into enterprise accounts and pilots that fizzled. But the possibility of future volume changes their internal math. They can justify a steeper discount to their manager by saying, this is a foot in the door. Even if the manager knows it might not pan out, the narrative works.
I want to dig into something you mentioned earlier. The composite case study with the wire shelving units. Can you walk through that in detail?
Yeah, this is instructive. A buyer, let's call them a composite of several people I've talked to, needed 4 wire shelving units from a major industrial supplier. First attempt, they sent a message through the website contact form, how much for shelves? Radio silence for a week.
That's not a quote request. That's a vague gesture in the direction of a quote request.
Second attempt, same supplier, different approach. They included the exact SKU, let's say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, quantity 4, delivery to a commercial address with a dock, requested net 30 terms. They received a quote within 4 hours, and the quote was 15% below the published list price.
Same buyer, same product, same supplier. The only variable was the structure of the ask.
Here's what I think is happening psychologically. When a rep opens an email that says SKU12345 Kwai Tai 4 Dock High Delivery to zip code 06103 Net 30, their brain goes, this person knows what they're doing. I can process this in 90 seconds and move on. The 15% discount is basically a convenience fee they're paying you for not wasting their time.
The opposite case is equally telling. The vague request, what's your best price, typically gets a link to the public catalog. Not even a quote, just a redirect to the self-service channel, which is the supplier's polite way of saying, we don't want this business at the price you're hoping for.
What's your best price? Is a terrible question in B2B for another reason. It signals that you haven't done your homework, because if you had, you'd know the approximate market range, and you'd be asking a more specific question. It also signals that you're price only, which means you'll probably jump to the next supplier for a nickel. Reps hate price-only buyers because there's no loyalty, no relationship, no future volume, just a race to the bottom.
We've covered the initial RFQ, but you said something earlier that I want to circle back to. The quote is not the final price. Once you have that first quote in hand, the game isn't over. In fact, that's where the real leverage starts.
Most buyers treat the quote as a take-it-or-leave-it final offer. That's a mistake. The quote is an opening position. Most B2B quotes have built-in margin for negotiation, especially if the buyer has already signaled low cost to serve. The question is, how you negotiate without becoming the squeaky wheel we just talked about?
How do you counter without haggling?
The key is structured counters that reference specific comparables. Not, can you do better? But I noticed the line item price on SQ12345 is $87.50. I was hoping to land closer to 72 based on comparable quotes from competitor X. Can you revisit that line? This works on multiple levels. You're not asking for a favor, you're presenting market data. You're making it easy for the rep to go to their manager and say, we're losing on price to competitor X, I need approval to drop to 72. You're giving them the internal justification.
The specificity matters. 87.50 to 72 is a precise ask. It's not somewhere in the 70s. It says you've done the math.
It signals that if they hit that number, the deal is probably done. Reps love certainty of close. A specific counter with a competitor reference is basically saying, meet this and I'll stop shopping. That's worth a lot.
Let's talk about timing. I've heard you mention before that when you send a quote request matters almost as much as what's in it.
This is one of those things that sounds like a hack, but is actually just understanding how sales organizations work. B2B sales quotas are typically monthly or quarterly. In the last week of a month, and especially the last week of a quarter, reps are scrambling to hit their numbers. They have more pricing flexibility because the internal pressure to close deals is higher. There was a Gong.io analysis from 2023 that quantified this. Deals closed in the final 5 days of a quarter had an average discount 8% higher than deals closed mid-quarter.
8% is meaningful. On a $1,000 order, that's $80. On a $5,000 order, it's $400. That's real money for doing nothing except timing your email.
The mechanism is straightforward. Mid-quarter, a rep might hold out for better margin because they have time. Last week of the quarter, the calculation flips. A discounted deal that counts toward quota is better than no deal at all. The rep's incentive and your incentive temporarily align.
I want to share a personal example that still makes me laugh. I requested a quote on a Thursday afternoon last week of the month for some racking units. Within 30 minutes. 30 minutes. I got a phone call from the rep, not an email. A phone call. Offering free shipping and a 10% discount without me asking for either.
That's the end of month effect in action. The rep saw a clean RFQ land in their inbox on the 28th, did the math on their quota gap, and decided to close it immediately with whatever concessions they could offer without approval. Free shipping and 10% is probably within their discretionary range, and it's a one-call close.
I hadn't done anything special except send a structured request at the right time. I wasn't a big buyer. I wasn't a repeat customer. I was just easy to say yes to at a moment when they needed to say yes to something.
Which brings us to another underutilized tactic, sample and demo programs. A lot of industrial suppliers have hidden programs for evaluation units at steep discounts. These aren't advertised on the website. They're managed by product managers or marketing teams, not the sales department.
How do you find these?
You ask the right person, not the sales rep. The sales rep is incentivized to sell at full margin. But if you can get to a product manager or someone in channel marketing, you frame it as, I'm evaluating your shelving system against competitor Y for a potential multi-unit deployment. Do you have a demo or evaluation program that would let me test a unit before committing to a larger order?
That's a completely different conversation. You're not a buyer anymore. You're a potential channel partner or a reference account.
Product managers care about adoption and market share, not margin on individual units. They have budgets for samples and eval units. A product manager who's trying to get their shelving system into more warehouses might happily send you a unit at 50% off if they think you'll influence other buyers or expand your deployment.
The organizational chart is a map of incentives. Sales wants margin. Marketing wants adoption. Product wants feedback. If you're only talking to sales, you're leaving 2/3 of the discount opportunities on the table.
That's beautifully put. And it connects to the bundle strategy, which is another way to change which incentive structure you're dealing with. If you're buying 2 shelving units at $200 each, you're a $400 order. That might not even hit the minimum for a dedicated rep. But if you add 20 plastic bins, a label maker, and a dolly to that same quote request, suddenly you're a $1,200 order.
Which crosses some internal threshold.
Most B2B suppliers have tiered sales attention. Below $500, you might get the self-service portal. $500 to $1,500, you get a junior rep or a pooled team. Above $1,500, you might get a named account manager. By bundling complementary items into a single RFQ, you can push yourself into a higher tier without buying more of the expensive item.
The bins and labels are things you probably need anyway if you're setting up a storage system. You're not padding the order with junk. You're consolidating purchases that would have happened separately.
And the rep sees a larger total and thinks this is worth my time. The 12% volume discount they can offer on the bundle might more than offset the cost of the accessories. You end up with a better price on the shelving and the bins than if you'd bought them separately.
Let me throw a scenario at you. What happens when the supplier says, we don't sell to individuals? I've hit this wall before, especially with industrial suppliers who are used to dealing with warehouses and distribution centers.
This is a framing problem more than a policy problem. When a supplier says, we don't sell to individuals, what they usually mean is, we don't sell to residential addresses with no business identifiers because the fraud risk and return rate are too high. The solution is to present yourself as a business entity, which you may already be even if you're working from home.
What are the concrete things that make a home business look like a business to their system?
First, have a registered business name. It doesn't need to be an LLC. A sole proprietorship with a DBA doing business as is fine. Second, have an EIN, an employer identification number from the IRS. It's free, you can get it online in 10 minutes, and it's the universal signal that you're a business entity. Third, use a business email address, not Gmail, or at least not a personal sounding Gmail, your name at yourbusinessdomain.com. Fourth, describe your delivery address in commercial terms. Home office, commercial zone, ground floor entrance with loading access. That's true, it's accurate, and it sounds like a business location to someone processing shipping logistics.
Ground floor entrance with loading access is doing a lot of work there. It's not a warehouse dock, but it's also not my driveway. Please don't block the mailbox.
It answers the question the shipping department is actually asking, which is, can we get a pallet to this location without complications? If the answer is yes, and you can describe it in terms they recognize, the residential versus commercial distinction often stops mattering.
Another objection I've run into is the minimum order quantity. We only sell by the pallet. How do you handle that?
Sometimes the answer is no, and you move on. But sometimes the answer is not directly, but here's who can help you. This is the stocking distributor referral. Many B2B manufacturers have authorized resellers who specialize in smaller quantities. These distributors buy by the pallet and break bulk for smaller customers. Their pricing will be higher than the manufacturer's pallet price, but often lower than retail, and they're happy to sell you 3 units.
How do you ask for that referral?
When the manufacturer says they can't meet your quantity, you say, I understand. Do you have a stocking distributor in the Northeast who handles smaller quantities of this product line? Using the term stocking distributor signals you know the channel structure. The rep is more likely to give you a real referral rather than just saying, check our website.
Because you've demonstrated you understand their business model. You're not arguing with their policy. You're asking for the legitimate workaround within their system.
Reps appreciate that. They'd rather give you a useful referral than argue with you about minimums for 10 minutes. A referral to a distributor might even earn them a small internal credit for channel development. It turns a no into a not yet, but here.
I want to pull on a thread we touched earlier. The psychology of the easy customer. You mentioned the Harvard Business Review study about reps spending 40% of their time on admin. What are the specific behaviors that make a buyer easy, beyond the initial RFQ?
Response time is a huge one. If a rep sends you a clarifying question and you respond in 15 minutes, you've just distinguished yourself from 90% of their inbox. Fast response signals that you're organized, you're serious, and you're not going to disappear for 3 weeks and then resurface with a completely different request.
Which is apparently common enough that just being responsive is a competitive advantage.
It's astonishing how low the bar is. Another signal, never ask a question that's answered on the product page. If the spec sheet says the shelf holds 800 pounds, don't ask how much weight can this hold. That tells the rep you didn't read the spec sheet, which means you're going to ask more questions that are already answered, which means you're going to be work.
Do your homework before you engage. Read the spec sheet, the installation guide, the shipping policy. Show up already informed.
The third signal is what I'd call decision readiness. When the quote arrives, don't say, let me think about it, and vanish. Either counter with specifics, as we discussed, or accept and move to order. The worst thing you can do to a rep is consume their time and then go silent. Reps remember that and they'll deprioritize you next time.
We've covered the RFQ structure, the framing of future volume, the timing strategy, the bundle, the sample programs, the distributor referral, and the easy customer behaviors. That's a lot of moving parts. If someone's listening and they want to use this tomorrow, what's the checklist?
Let me compress it into 7 items. 1. Prepare a line item list with SKUs, quantities, and preferred units of measure. 2. Include delivery logistics, address, dock type or ground level, zip code, any special access notes. 3. State your payment terms preference up front. 4. Imply future volume without committing to it. Use the pilot framing. 5. Time your request for the last week of a month or quarter if you can. 6. Bundle complementary items to raise the total order value. 7. When the quote arrives, follow up with a structured counter that references specific competitors if the pricing isn't where you need it.
The meta skill underneath all of that. Treat every quote request as a mini sales presentation where you are selling the seller on why you are an easy, low-risk customer. The product you're selling is your own professionalism.
The B2B quotation system isn't broken for small buyers. It's just calibrated for a different customer profile. Your job is to recalibrate it by changing the signals you send. You don't need to be a big buyer. You need to look like a buyer who knows what they're doing.
The signals are learnable. SKUs, not descriptions. Commercial address, not my house. Net 30, not how do I pay. Fast response, not I'll get back to you. These are small changes in behavior that produce disproportionate changes in outcome.
I think there's a broader point here about the nature of B2B sales that most small buyers miss. The seller isn't your adversary. They're not trying to extract maximum value from you. They're trying to close deals efficiently. If you align your behavior with their efficiency, they'll share the efficiency gains with you in the form of better pricing. It's not manipulation. It's incentive alignment.
The adversarial model of negotiation. Never let them see you sweat. Always ask for more than you want. Make them work for it. That model assumes a zero-sum game with a fixed pie. But in B2B, the pie expands when the transaction cost shrinks. A faster, cleaner deal creates surplus that both sides can capture.
The surplus shows up in places you don't expect. A unit from the demo pool at half price. A call from a rep saying, we just got a cancellation on a larger order, want to grab those shelves at the volume price? Those opportunities only flow to buyers who've established themselves as easy to work with.
Where does this leave us? I've been thinking about the future of all this. AI-powered procurement tools are becoming more common. People are using ChatGPT to generate RFQs Automated sourcing agents are scraping supplier websites. B2B marketplaces like Faire and Zoro are commoditizing small, quote, purchasing. Does the human art of the quote request become more or less valuable in that world?
I think it becomes more valuable, counterintuitively. When everyone can generate a mediocre RFQ with AI, the signal-to-noise ratio gets worse for suppliers. The buyers who stand out will be the ones who combine AI efficiency with human judgment, who use the tools to research SKUs and competitors, but who add the personal touch, the specific framing, the timing awareness that AI can't replicate.
The lo-fi girl of B2B procurement. Everyone's using the same automated tools, and the one person who sends a thoughtful, human-structured request gets the disproportionate response.
That's a perfect image. And for custom or industrial goods, the kind of shelving and storage systems Daniel's looking at, the personal RFQ remains the only path. These aren't commodities on a marketplace. You can't one-click buy a climate-controlled bin system. The quote process is the gate, and understanding its mechanics is a durable skill.
I think the through line here is that systems have seams. B2B sales is a system designed for volume, but the seams, end of quarter urgency, discretionary pricing authority, demo programs, distributor networks, are accessible to anyone who knows where to look and how to ask. The art is in finding the seams.
The seams are surprisingly wide once you know the language. That's the thing I want listeners to take away. You don't need to be a procurement professional with a $100,000 budget. You need to spend 15 minutes preparing your RFQ instead of typing how much for shelves into a contact form. The ROI on that 15 minutes in terms of discounts received and attention unlocked is probably the highest of anything you'll do in your purchasing process.
Try one of these tactics this week. Time something for month end. Add a SKU to a request you'd normally leave vague. See what happens. The system responds to structure more than it responds to scale.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, real tennis players on the Kuril Islands were expected to announce their own faults before the marker could call them, and failing to do so was considered not just a rules violation, but a breach of personal honor that could result in a formal challenge outside the court.
I have so many questions about tennis in the Kuril Islands.
None of which we're going to answer.
This has been my Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. Go send a core request and see what happens.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.